since his mother-in-law, rather, since his father's wife, his stepmother, is living in the courtyard, Einenu chayavim lehotziyam yetzlo. We're not obligated to take her away. V'yim beitin sricha lehotziyah. And if the court is obligated to separate the slave girl from this young man, me'ezatam tiyahotzata. Where do we find, what would be the grounds for this? Sofi shalom apsan matzinu sha'asur eli yukut niyab yukut begoyah. We only found the prohibition against being alone with a single Jewish girl or being alone with a non-Jewish woman. But not, we don't have any clear law on this about what about being alone with a slave girl. If the court must take some action here, what would be the grounds for such action? This is Dr. Kane's question. Does the law of Yefatoar apply to this situation about the beautiful captive girl? The Torah mentions a beautiful captive girl, but here all we have is a beautiful slave girl. Yovenu Rabbeinu Scharo Kapol Min HaShemayim. What to do? That's the question. Tshuva. Now here's the Rambam's answer. Ein la din Yefatoar. The law of Yefatoar doesn't apply. Lafisha zot nityach David in Torah. The laws of Yefat Torah were a specific ruling, exceptional ruling in the Torah. Mishum shumutah likha li'isha ba'ota ha'eit. Rasoni lomar ba'eit ha'kibush. Kishahi ba'giyuta. The Torah allowed the man to take this woman to be to his wife, to bed, at the time of the conquest, while she was still non-Jewish. The Torah was only responding to the passions of war. The Gemara says that it was permissible for them in that time to eat things that were prohibited. Because the Torah said, because now we have to skip from one plus to the next. Uvatim leim kol tum afilu kadli dechazir. The Gemara in Chulin says that at the time of the conquest, the Jews were allowed to even eat the bacon that was in the conquest. Ein lahakish al zeh. You cannot derive anything from the law of Yefat Torah. Utsuchim beitin achar zot hashmu. Utsuchim beitin achar zot lo shmu asher lo tava. Since this is a bad rumor, lahotzia, to take her out of his house. And the Rambam says, skipping to the next plus, O Yishachra'ena, the courts will either demand that he take her out of the house, O Yishachra'ena, V'yisa'ena le'isha, or let him set her free and marry her. Afal b'sheyesh b'zeh ke'ena be'ra, even though there is a, he says ke'ena be'ra, but our Mishnah says very explicitly that I did ana l'shifcha lo yichnos, even though there is a even though the Mishnah says that someone who is suspected of having relations with a slave and she is set free is not allowed to marry her, because we have already decided several times on such similar circumstances, that he should set the master should set the slave girl free and marry her. We have done this in order to help people do tshuva. In other words, in order to open the gates of repentance, we have allowed this marriage to take these type marriages to take place, even though the Mishnah after free her. Free her, and then he allows him to marry.
Conversion. Isn't that free her and convert?
Well, once she becomes free, if she is a shivcha, setting her free will make her fully Jewish.
Why is that a tshuva? Why is that a takanas hashavah?
The Mishnah says that a man who is suspected of having sex with a slave or with a slave girl is not allowed to marry her after manumission, after he's set free. He is saying that in order to let this man return to living a full religious Jewish life, we will strike out that ruling of the Mishnah. That's what he means in Hakanat HaShavim. Well, let me ask you. The Mishnah says, don't marry a slave if you're suspected of having relations with him. And the Rambam is saying, you may. That's not talking about an untrue slave, that's talking about an Amalek. It's entirely different.
So the issue.
The situation is the Mishnah says two things, or three things, or several things. The Mishnah says that a man who is suspected of having sex with a non-Jewish woman is not allowed to marry her after she converts. And Rav Shlomo Kluger has stricken that rule.
What happened? As with the Kavya, they urge the people to get rid of their Russian.
We'll have to study that in some detail. And we will have to go over the entire historical.
Well, they read this Jewish.
They should have converted. We'll have to study all of these things in some detail. That's why I said at the beginning that we're entering this subject in the middle.
Okay.
But I think it's to get a grasp on it, we should enter it in the middle. All I'm saying is that had Shlomo Kluger been aware of this tshuva of the Rambam, he could have cited it as a precedent because it's to the identical decision. It's a situation where, in order to allow this person to live a full religious life, he's striking out a ruling of the Mishnah. And whereas Shlomo Kluger isn't as forthright about it as the Rambam, the Rambam is quite forthright. The Amarnu, Rambam says, the Amarnu mutav shiyochal rotav v'lo shuman atzmo. It's better that he eat broth than the actual fat. Okay? Eight, the samachnu al divrei hemzal, and we have relied on the famous statement in the Gemara, eight lasot lashem heferu torotech, that in order to do something for the for God's sake, we have revoked the Torah. In other words, he moved around on this. Rav Shlomo Kluger is looking for some way of pretending that his ruling was consistent with the Gemara and the Mishnah. The Rambam is just simply saying straight out that I'm overruling the Mishnah. The Mishnah says that the man should not be allowed to marry a converted slave that he was suspected of having relations with him. And here the Rambam is saying, let's just simply strike that in the books. And that's what he's doing. And the court should fix a terminus, what do you say, ad quem?
Time limit.
Give a time limit,
deadline,
bite the bullet, either set her free and get her out of the house, or marry her. Kamosha asa Ezra, okay, Baruch Kimi Taler, Yitaken Kilkulenu, Kamosha Tiaf Yamava Asirai, Kolben Yilayah, or Katav Moshe. So that's the Rambam. So very clear. Of course, the Rambam was talking about had a lot of cases with a slave girl because at the time of the Rambam, slavery was still alive. It wasn't as the high point of the slave trade in this region in our sources for maybe a couple of centuries before, and we'll have to spend some time looking at the Jewish involvement in slavery and the slave trade. But still, in the Rambam's time as well, the idea of Jews owning non-Jewish slaves was still around, and people were still engaged in the slave trade. The slaves were coming from all over. There weren't black slaves. There were some black slaves, but they were also from the Slavic countries. That's the origin of the word Slavic, after all, and various other places. So slavery existed, and less. Yeah, we'll talk about the famous case was Bustanai, we'll have to review that case also. But that was many hundred years before the Rambam.
I don't understand how we're going on to something else.
No, no, what do you have a question?
It's pretty strong stuff if you can take something from the Mishnah.
Yeah, it's pretty strong stuff. Well, you have to be the Rambam to say.
That's my next one. How does he? I mean, because he's the accepted authority for that whole.
He was the accepted authority for the whole generation.
He didn't need that.
Right.
He didn't need a court of three or a.
That's right.
That's
right. He was sufficiently aware of his own power, and his rulings were sufficiently accepted through the.
Nobody took exception.
It must have been
way out, your way out.
Social problem. He was dealing with a serious social problem, and he was sufficiently self-confident and had the confidence of the entire community because he was the Rambam. Right? Shlomo Kluger could only say the same thing by saying that he's reading it into the tradition. The Rambam didn't make any pretense of that, but he was doing the same thing that Shlomo Kluger did, but a little more brutally, maybe. A little more openly. But I wanted to make a slightly different point because it's interesting and also something that will lead to us. The Rambam posed this problem. For the Rambam, this was an actual problem having to deal with slaves. It wasn't an actual problem in having to deal with issues of relations between free Jewish men and free non-Jewish women of Basilos. With Rav Shlomo Kluger, the situation was reversed because there were no slaves in Europe at the time of Rav Shlomo Kluger. But the problem of intimate relations between Jews and non-Jews was just starting in his time, and however we deal with this problem, which Shlomo Kluger represents for us perhaps the starting point of a whole series of more and more complicated and difficult problems that we will try to come to grips with. It's interesting, for instance, to see the relative placement of the laws of slavery and the laws of conversion between the Rambam's code, between the Yad HaChazakah and the Shulchan Aruch. In the Shulchan Aruch, Hilchot Avadim, the laws of slaves, come between Hilchot Milah and Hilchot Gevur, Hilchot Gevur. It's part of the Yevadea, it's part of ritual law. So for the Shulchan Aruch, for the Tur, basically the organization of the Shulchan Aruch is due to the Tur, for the Tur, already, although at the time of the Tur, slavery there may have been some remnants of it, a little bit of household servants who were halfway between being slaves in the old-fashioned sense and not being slaves, but nevertheless it was not a business for anybody, Jewish and non-Jewish, to get into. It became a business again in the 16th and the 17th century with the opening up of the New World, which was based on slavery. But in the 14th century, slavery was no longer a reality. And that's why for the Tur, it was only a ritual problem, part of Yevadea, and it was probably mainly a hypothetical problem. The Rambam, of course, puts Hilchot Avadim where it belongs, namely as part of the laws of contract. Right, it's part of Hilchot Kinyan. Slaves are a form of property, and therefore, whatever the laws of slavery are, there may be a whole lot of complicated laws about it because you have to be partially converted and what have you, but nevertheless, the natural place for them is in the property law, so there are no places in the property law. Now, what about the relative position of Hilchot Gerim? The Tur puts Hilchot Gerim, as I said, after Hilchot Avadim, right after Hilchot Milah, and after all, it's a natural place. It's part of the ritual law. It's after after we decide how to bring young Jewish boys into the Bitosh Shel Avraham Avinu. They have a little section on Hilchot Avadim, and then you get to Hilchot Gerim. Where does the Rambam put Hilchot Gerim? Does anyone remember where Hilchot Gerim actually finds its place? And exactly, it's in Hilchot Yisurei Biyah. For the Rambam, the primary issue of Hilchot Gerim is on the issue of prohibited sexual relations. Whether the Rambam was concerned mainly with when sexual relations between a man and a woman become permissible after the appropriate partner converts, or whether he was primarily concerned with the issue of that Gael and therefore the rules of incest, at least in principle, should not necessarily apply to him. For the Rambam, Hilchot Gerim becomes a part of a becomes part of the laws of prohibited sexual relations. And this reflects, I think, something that we mentioned last year in the Shiur, namely that the Spanish community, the Sephardic community as a whole, didn't regard itself in ideological conflict with the surrounding Christian or Muslim community as much as the Ashkenazi communities did. For the Ashkenazi communities, a ger, even though it was extremely rare, represented an ideological victory. They were always in a state of tension with the surrounding Christian community. For the Rambam, of course, Rambam on the one hand is a universalist. So he regards the idea, the abstract idea of the Ge'er as being very attractive, and he wrote that beautiful letter to Obadiah HaGe'er and said some beautiful things about Ge'er. But for the Rambam, it wasn't an everyday ideological tension, and therefore the conflict between Jews and non-Jews and the winning of converts to one side was not considered to him as being an issue of primary importance. The number of converts, as we said, in both the Muslim and the Christian communities during this period was relatively small. So the Rambam sort of shoves this topic into a place where it really doesn't belong from our perspective, namely in the laws of prohibited sections.
I think he was concerned about its presence in the
I don't think that that was an issue for the Rambam. I don't know that non-Jews had a higher influence than Jews. I don't think this was a relative. Okay, so this is an opening wedge into an impossible topic, which is the laws of Gevurot in general, because for Rav Shlomo Kluger, still the issue was that this woman was converting in order to be able to marry the Jewish boy, but presumably she understood what she was going to get in for, and if she was going to live in the Jewish community, there was not going to be any question about her observance of all the laws and so on. Of course, with successive generations, we get into the kinds of problems that Mr. Weinstein is referring to. How sincere, how much Kabbalah's old mitzvahs are, is there really in the issue of converts? So, ultimately, the Lord, as I had these discussions with the Lord many, many times, and although we didn't agree on the final outcome of these discussions, I think we both agreed that one cannot separate problems of conversion from the problems of Jewish identity as a whole. I mean, if conversion means becoming a Jew, then the issue of what is a Ge'er can't be separated from what is a Jew. And of course, that's an impossible question to give a final answer that's agreeable to any two people sitting at the same table, but nevertheless, we have to make some attempt at it. And of course, with something like the laws of the return in Israel, it gets complicated with political issues, so it's a really horrendous subject. So you should commend me for my bravery in undertaking it, even though you may not agree with any conclusions that we reach. This, even though Mr. Weinstein finds this tshuva of the Rambam shocking and that of Shlomo Kluger a little disturbing, once we get into the history of the subject, we're going to see things which are much more complicated, disturbing, difficult, and incomprehensible. For example, the historical evidence and the archaeological evidence is extremely hard to manage. Here's for example, a piece of evidence, and we'll sustain it by lots of citations from Yitz Hashem next week, or the week after, from Josephus and Philo and other ancient sources. Namely, that the Gemara's picture of conversions of Gevurot couldn't really... I mean, the Gemara is ambivalent. The Gemara has a lot of positive statements about conversions, and it has several famous negative assertions about conversions. But the Gemara that we just learned, namely of restricting conversions to ones which are purely sincere, doesn't jive with the historical facts. After all, we know that Hyrcanus captured a lot of territory and forcibly converted a large number of Idumeans and various other territories. We'll see Josephus' descriptions of these events. So that there are certainly forced conversions. On the issue of slavery, when there was a large slave trade, and we're going to have to spend one shiur, I think, just for the analysis and historical evidence regarding the slave trade, it may very well be, we'll find that there's a difference of opinion amongst the Shuras HaGaonim as to whether when you're, after the law is that if you buy a slave and you keep them, you have to have Mila and Tefila. In other words, that's sort of a semi-conversion. Now, are we to believe that this was all done with a voluntary, high religious, moral purpose on the part of the slave himself? The Gaonim debate as to whether this has to be voluntary, but it's hard for us to imagine that in any but a small percentage of cases where someone buys a slave and keeps them, or buys a whole collection of slaves for his plantation or what have you, and forcibly converts these slaves, that there was voluntary conversion. Maybe I'm being overduly harsh, but in any event, and now what about the numbers? Well, if we go back before the time of the Bible, I think all demographic evidence is questionable, but let's accept as a reasonable approximation Baron's estimates for Jewish population. The estimate that you get for Jewish population at the end of Bayit Rishon, the beginning of Bayit Sheni, is roughly 150,000 Jews. The estimate for the first century, even before or after the Christian era, is 8 million Jews. One out of every 10 people living in the Roman Empire is Jewish. I mean, if you extrapolate to today, that means several hundred million, maybe a billion Jews. So one is not that many, not a billion, but certainly several hundred million Jews. Right. Whatever it is, the growth in 5 centuries or 4 centuries from 150,000 to 8 million cannot be attributed to a natural increase. No population is increasing. So therefore, one must be led to the conclusion that the overwhelming proportion of this increase is due to conversion. So there was a massive movement for conversion starting maybe 200 or 300 before the Christian era, working its way up to the first century of Christian era. And then with the
kind of Philo,
yes. I mean, you had at the time of Philo, or
a lot of
you had the Jewish population in Egypt, the bulk of which was living in Alexandria, was 1 million Jews. That's a large number. I mean, the number, you know, it's like New York City. It's not that
huge. Why all these conversions?
Well, we have to look into that. Some of them were forced conversions. Most of them were ideological conversions. And we will find, when we look at the evidence, that in addition to the converts, that is, people who actually performed circumcision, there was a large population of, for use of a better word, that we'll call the Judaizers, people who were sympathetic to Judaism, fellow travelers who were attracted to the high ideals of monotheism and the purity of the Jewish family and Shabbat. It's not Erevah. It's an entirely different phenomenon. In the case of the Erevah, one is dealing with some political conversion, and the Torah is describing to us a number of people who, like the Gemaras, like talking about, who came along to the Jews because it was to their material advantage. And hence, to Dr. Schwaber, one must see that there was a large propaganda. I don't want, propaganda has a negative connotation. There was a large attraction within the pagan world to the positive ideals of Judaism, monotheism, healthy family life, Shabbat, and so on. And there are many people who did not go all the way, and those presumably formed the nucleus of the converts to Christianity. So there was some period of time in which Christianity took over this proselytizing spirit and won the war in some sense. But up until that time, there was not only a large mass of converts, but there were large groups of people who were semi-converts. Even this is disputed amongst the archaeologists, but we'll see what some of the more recent things talk about.
The rough numbers, people have said that there would have been many more. The only thing that held them back, conversion, was the Mila and Shabbat. Christianity came in, they eliminated those problems.
I think it was Mila kept them away. Yeah. Shabbat apparently was much more of an attractive force than a repelling force.
I thought he said Mila.
Certainly circumcision is a major step to take. We'll see this in Josephus. But before we go to Josephus, I think we have to go back to see the meaning of the word ger as it occurs in Tanakh. And there we'll also see that I think what we're going to have to do is maybe spend 3/4 of that. There are about 40 or 50 places in which the word ger.
The Gemara mentions Ge'er Tosha. The question is whether the Gemara's usage of that terminology coincides with the simple interpretation of the text as we have it. In almost all cases, not in all cases, but in almost all cases of the texts that we will see, and if you have the patience, we'll go through all of them in one session. Next time, in Yes Hashem, we will find that the word Ge'er, as it occurs, does not mean convert at all. It simply means resident alien. In other words, when the Republicans are saying that we're going to take rights away from illegal, you may have a Ge'er and a Ge'er Toshav, or you may have a legal alien and an illegal alien, and the Torah is telling you to be kind to all of them and not to be harsh or mistreat any of your resident aliens. But the resident alien is not a Jew, he's a resident alien. The Gemara later reads into this, and as I said, there's some exceptions. But the simplest interpretation of the overwhelming majority is that just as it says, Kigerim, Higitem Be'aretz Mitzrayim, means that you also have resident aliens in your midst, and you have to treat them kindly. You cannot be harsh to and a ger is perhaps not only a resident alien, but a poor resident alien, right? An imported agricultural worker or what have you. You bring in the Mexicans in order to get the cheap farm labor, and then you don't want to put the kids in school. I mean, some sort of hypocrisy like that we find currently in California, and that's what the Torah and most and the Nevi'im are warning us against. So the word ger, as it occurs mostly in the Tanakh, is referring to some concept quite different from the Gemara has to deal with this problem and has this category of Ge'er Tosha. But that also doesn't include all of these people that we were just describing as Judaizers. So they have for them a different name called Yirei Shamayim or Tzadikei Musa Olam or what have you. Still a different terminology. And then has a specific terminology meaning for Ge'er Tosha. And then when we come to the medieval period, like say the Ramban, he has still different terminology because neither of these is able to jive with his theory. So one thing is the issue of terminology and another is the issue of facts. And I, if you have the patience, maybe we'll spend 3 or 4 more shiurim or even more on this topic. We will not, I'm warning you in advance, we will not come to any resolution of this problem because, as I say, the issue is much too ideological and much too controversial to be able to come to a firm conclusion, but what we will be able to do is to get some historical perspective on it, and also maybe after going back a few thousand years, come forward and see what were the consequences of Moshe Kruger's Pesach, and see how they developed in the later Tribal literature up to the present time. So I'm going to go back 3,000 years next week, and then work on the forward.
He was flying for a visa to the United States. And he went around the corner and bought a lottery. The Israeli lottery. And he won. And he had then
Let me show you this book that I was talking about.
They want their share.
And they were calling me.
What about an Arab rock? One of those guys.